You are now online with Andrea, with your host, Andrea Garrison.
Welcome. You are now online with Andrea. I am your host, Andrea Garrison. I'd like to encourage all of our listeners to practice the universal law of giving by doing whatever you can to reach out to help others. Our topic today is the book, What Can I Say? A Guide to Visiting Friends and Family Who Are Ill. And our guest today is author Simon Fox, who's the executive director of the Adventures in Caring Foundation. Welcome. How are you today?
Thank you, Andrea. Thank you for having me on today. I'm very well, thank you. Very well.
Good. When I saw your precious little book and read it, I just loved it. Very passionate about the topic, and I said, what a wonderful topic around the holiday season. And the work that you do is so important. So I hope that people will be inspired to support the work of your organization. Now, if you would please share with us a little bit about your background and your wife's background, who's also the co-author of this wonderful book, What Can I Say? If you can tell us led to the development of the Adventures in Caring Foundation.
Sure, happy to do that. Credit where credit's due. My wife created the organization. Karen's very gifted in connecting with people who are very seriously ill, mostly because she's had health challenges her whole life. So she really knows what it's like to be a patient in the hospital, in the home. She's had several life-threatening illnesses and still does struggle with it. Combine that with the fact that she grew up mostly overseas. Even though she's born in Oklahoma, she grew up in Ethiopia and Iraq and Italy mostly, and then returned to the States because her dad was with the State Department. And so what happened was Karen developed this ability to connect with all kinds of people, languages. I mean, she spoke French, Italian, Aramaic, Arabic, and English, and maybe one other language. And so she was able to connect with people from Emperor Haile Selassie all the way to the lepers in the marketplace. So she's a very gifted communicator. And truth in advertising, I am not. And my background is in physics, typically reserved Brit, now an expat in America. And I had none of the skills that Karen had. And so when we met, she was doing this work of visiting patients in the hospital and asked me if I'd like to tag along, which I did, and I was stunned by what she was able to accomplish in a relatively few minutes interacting with people. It really opened my eyes as to what is possible when communication supports healing rather than getting in the way of it. So that's a little bit. I'm happy to say more on that, but that's in brief how we started working together, because Karen was being asked, you know, by other people saying, I would like to volunteer in this way. And the question was then, well, is this a gift or can it be passed on to other people? Is it teachable? And I hope we all know a gifted doctor or a gifted nurse or physical therapist or mental health professional who is gifted at connecting with people who are very ill. And a few are, and a lot are not. And so we can't say this is a unique gift that Karen had, but it's a rather rare one. And it's that kind of person really can put people at ease, even when they're feeling threatened, even when they're afraid because they don't know if they're going to survive the experience, to help them feel encouraged and to have hope and to have also feel that there is somebody in their corner, that they have an ally with them through thick and thin. And it's a real gift.
Yeah, it's beautiful work. In your book, you say, an illness can be a tragedy and it can be a turning point. It is often an opportunity for two souls to meet, whether you have just met the person or you have been together for a lifetime. Don't assume you know everything about him or her. Illness brings up new issues and new perceptions. And if you look for the good, the beauty, the strength, and the wisdom, you will find it. All it takes is your full and generous attention.
Yeah, that's the first step, if you will, in this way of, in order to teach it, what happened was we had to figure out, well, what exactly is one of these gifted communicators, what is that person actually doing? And the first thing we noticed was they're all excellent observers, and they really do give people their undivided attention so that people feel heard and respected. And so when you do that, I mean, when we're teaching students this, that's job one, is to get the attention off of ourselves and onto the other person. And this, as easy as that is to say, it's more difficult to do. It's especially more difficult to do when we're worried, because we're usually wrapped up in our own feelings about how worried we are and what's the diagnosis and what's next. And it takes a conscious effort to wonder what is important to the person who's going through the experience. We often say it's like being, you know, you're the two people in the same room, but in two different worlds. The healthy person has, you know, confidence that they're going to walk out of that room, hale and hearty, and the person in the bed is wondering, well, maybe not. And there's a very big difference in worldview at that point. And so the challenge is to build a bridge over to the other person's world to find out what's going on over there. And we can't assume, like you, the quote you just read, we can't assume that we know, even if we've known that person for years, because perspectives can change radically when mortality is an issue, when people might be facing the end of life. And just the specter of that changes our perspective markedly.
Yeah.
And so it takes a conscious effort to wonder. There's a quote by Parker Palmer, which is, I love it, because he said, when the going gets tough, turn to wonder. I wonder what she's feeling right now. I wonder why he said that. You know, when I wonder what's important to them at this moment in time. And when you wonder that way, your attention naturally goes over to that person to look for the answer or to listen for the answer. And that's, we're so habitually trained to focus on ourselves, our own performance, our own concerns, our own goals, or the things we want to accomplish. We often forget about what's important to another person, so we never actually really meet them, because we're concerned about making a good impression, and they're concerned about making a good impression, and you don't actually really even meet, because you're wrapped up in yourself, and it's one of the ironic things about life. So it does take that conscious effort to engage and be interested in what they're interested in.
And how important is it for us to know that others recognize our existence? You know, and I was thinking about that, because you were talking about how we're so self-absorbed. But for someone, when you're caring for someone else who is not well, how is important is it for them to feel that they are important at that time, that they are important to you? And how do you communicate that? Because if you're self-absorbed, sometimes it's hard to get out of yourself.
Yes,
you know
it
what
is.
I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, that's why I said it's a conscious effort. And to answer your question, how important it is, it's vital. I mean, it's hard to overstate how important it is. I mean, the recent research on social isolation is ranking social isolation as a healthcare risk up there with smoking 15 cigarettes a day or being an alcoholic, and twice as dangerous to your health as being obese. So it's you know, the research is now starting to show how devastating social isolation can be. So what's the antidote to that is acknowledgement, acknowledging people's existence. Kip Williams has done great research on ostracism, and some of the quotations from the people he interviewed are jaw-dropping. When people talk about bullying and abuse, and people will say, I wish I had been beaten rather than ignored, because at least someone would have acknowledged my existence.
Yeah, so you know what I'm thinking as I'm listening to you is this really goes beyond the person who's dealing with illness, but
yeah.
We can even extend caring to those who are alone.
Very much so. Very much so, because we wonder why people kind of fade away or fail to thrive is the term. And it's seen in infants. I mean, it was seen in Elsie Whittison's research on World War II orphanages in Britain, how they were all military run at that time because there were a lot of orphans due to the Blitz and things like that. And some orphans thrived and some did not. And it was all about the acknowledgement. Was there existence acknowledged? They all got the same shelter and they all got the same food and they all got the same clothing. That wasn't the issue. What the issue was, did the matron pay attention to them and connect with them and give a hug when necessary, or totally ignore them? And that's the children in the orphanages where they were ignored. They were given food and they were given shelter and they were given clothing, but other than that, they were ignored. They failed to thrive and they just withered away. Well, all people are like that, and especially the frail elderly. But everybody it withers away without their existence being acknowledged. Even in Aboriginal tribes, one of the capital punishments that is usually fatal is if someone's done something particularly egregious against the tribe, they are shunned, and the tribe acts as if that person does not exist. They refuse to acknowledge their existence from that point on. And usually the person goes away and within a few days or weeks just withers away and dies.
Wow.
Because nobody admits that they even exist. And so that's how punishing that can be. I mean, it can be fatal. So it gives you a sense of how important it is. We all need that. And we need to be acknowledged for all kinds of reasons, but mostly our existence, that we exist, that we're a person. We have not just a patient, not just an illness, not just a consumer or of healthcare services, but an actual person with a life and relationships and things that are important or meaningful to us. We all need that.
Yeah.
And you know how nourishing it is when someone takes an interest in what you're interested in. You know, say you have some strange hobby that very few people are interested in. You collect something, or you're fascinated by something, and you can't find anybody who can even relate. And then you find somebody who does, or maybe they can't relate at first, but they're just interested and asks you to explain, you know, how on earth you're interested in this particular obscure thing, and what great joy you find by explaining it to them. You know, I remember talking to a retired priest about that. He was very proud about doing this whole translation of the works of Duns Scotus. He was a Franciscan priest, and Duns Scotus was an ancient Franciscan around about the 1200s. And Father Walter says, you know, he showed me his book. He's so proud. He just created it, and he translated from the Latin this work. And I opened the book up, and it's in Latin. And I said, Father, I thought you translated it from the Latin. You know, this work is like 800 years old. And he said, I did. I translated it from old German Latin into modern Latin. I mean, you know, who does that anymore, you know? But I took an interest in how he did that and why he did that and why it was so important to him. And he spent hours talking about it. And I learned a lot about history by doing so. So I think it's just the art of, you know, that is an acknowledgement when you take an interest in somebody's life, the stories in it and where they're from and what's been important to them or who has been important to them. And you never know. You can be very, very surprised by things like that. We might engage with people who are in these old, frail bodies, but inside that can be incredibly remarkable people. Usually are.
Yeah. Yeah, that's beautiful that you're reminding us of just how special we all are. I want to read another couple of excerpts from your book, your lovely little book. I'm telling you, this is a quick read for everyone, but certainly a powerful read and an important one. It says, all of us, especially when we are sick, need to know that others recognize our existence. So often, visitors talk about sick friends and relatives as if they weren't really there, ignoring their very existence and leaving them to feel invalidated or worse, like helpless victims. Express your recognition by speaking directly to the person who is sick, engaging him or her in a life-affirming conversation that leaves that person feeling encouraged and empowered. When you put into words your awareness of someone's strengths, unique abilities, and heartfelt longings, you help to preserve that person's dignity and bolster a desire to live and recover. You can also impact the course of the illness for the better. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, it's deep stuff, and it was very humbling to write it. Actually, I wrote some of this literally at Rose Medical Center in Denver, at the bedside of my wife, Karen, as she was actually having a life-threatening encounter, surgery. And so I was quite literally sitting right there. I don't think it was that paragraph you just read, but it was a couple of chapters of this book I wrote there. Acknowledgement literally means confession of knowledge. And so on our model, you know, the attention part is picking up the signals of what's important to somebody. And then the acknowledgement is sending the signal that I noticed, you know, letting them know that you recognize something there that was beautiful in them. And that other people have done work very similar called appreciative inquiry. It's similar. It really is. And the acknowledgement is, it's not enough to see something beautiful in somebody. The next step is, yeah, let them know that you saw it and acknowledge that. And especially when somebody is battling a severe illness or injury or somebody who's dying, to be able to appreciate them of what they've done in their life. Or what a beautiful characteristic they have. Maybe it's their sense of humor. Maybe it's their ability to tell great stories. Maybe they've just been a good friend. There's simple things, but they are very dear to our hearts and nourish our souls when we have that meaningful interaction. And it gives people to I think the art of it is making it safe for us to talk about things that are close to the heart. I mean, we're used to having, you know, professional level conversations, or, you know, kind of more superficial conversations. We tend to be less skilled in having the deeper ones about stuff that's going to matter. Well, stuff that's going to matter on our deathbed. I love it. There's a quote by John O'Donohue, a wonderful poet, who said something like, gather yourself and think carefully about the life you would love to live. Think carefully about the life you would that you would love to look back upon from your deathbed.
Mm.
Right? And so, what would you want to have done? What is precious to you? What is sacred to you? And to be able to give voice to those things while we're still alive, and honor them in our lives, and not just put them on the back shelf somewhere, but bring them out and share them with somebody, but in a safe way, not somebody who's going to trample all over your heart and discount those things, but somebody who you can be safe with to share something precious to you. And that's the art of doing this is what we're teaching, is how do you set it up so that trust can be built in a very genuine way. And believe me, when people are very seriously ill, BS will not work. You know, the false politeness or just trying to say the right words but not really meaning them will not cut it, because they are acutely aware of who is phony and who is for real. Because when your back is against the wall and you don't have much longer to live, or you might not have much longer to live, you start to be paying attention a whole new way. And they size people up all the time. But like, they size up the nurse. Is she competent, or is he competent? They've got the pain meds in their hands. Are they the right ones? Is it the right dosage? You know, when your pain is depending on them getting it right, you're paying attention very carefully. And so the same thing emotionally. And I beautiful friend of mine who's 91, I met with her a couple of days ago, and she said to me, you know, as we get older, we lose all kinds of things. You know, we lose our eyesight and our hearing, and we're not as tall as we used to be, and certainly not as fast and or as strong. But there's one thing we don't ever lose, and that's our emotions. They're just as strong and vibrant as they've ever been, if not more so.
Mm. Yeah.
And I think that has been missed in a lot of the way healthcare is practiced, is the forgetting that older people, yes, their minds might not work as quickly, and certainly their bodies don't, but their emotions are still there, just as full as they ever were.
Yeah. There's a quote in your book. It says, it's George Meltham. It says, of one thing I am certain, the body is not the measure of healing. Peace is the measure.
Yeah. And we see that especially as people pass on. And you might think it's strange to talk about healing and death in the same sentence, but there can be huge healing and reconciliation between family members, a person with them, their own selves. And if someone has a beautiful death, there is a presence of peace in the room during and afterwards that is utterly profound. Actually, it's very similar to the same presence in the room as somebody is being born. And there's this like golden light in there. And it's an amazing experience that enriches everyone who experiences it. So if it's done right, peace is definitely the measure. Yeah, that's what people want. When we're very sick, when we're in a lot of pain or injured, we want all to be well. We want to find peace. More than just escape the pain, we want to find a presence of peace. And, you know, that's, so the idea is like, well, so how do we communicate in such a way that it helps that begin to happen? You know, you can't make it happen, but you can kind of set up conditions so that it's likely to, if a person wants to go there or if they're ready to go there. And it's a different way of working, but that's comes, especially that piece comes out of acceptance. It's like when we are not judging a person or have expectations of what they ought to be doing, you know, like taking their vitamins, and, you know, I mean, there's the practical side of healthcare, and I'm not invalidating that. There are certain things we've got to do. But there's also that just welcoming of a person as is, you know, as they say, warts and all, you know, you just add the person as they are, just accepting them. And then when we do that, it's easier for them to accept themselves. And that's how we get to a more peaceful place.
Yeah. You also talk about affection, the power of touch, and how important it is for people to be aware that people react differently to affection.
Yes, I think people are actually starved for affection. People are so scared of touching these days, because of the way it's portrayed in the media and gossiped about. But when somebody's ill, sometimes words don't cut it. Sometimes they just, in order to communicate that I'm here for you, it's just, you know, like a warm hand on a hand, you know, or a hand on a shoulder, or a hand on a cheek, or, you know, there's lots of ways to show affection. I would say first you've got to pay attention, because, as they say, different strokes for different folks, right? You know, it's like some people like bear hugs, other people do not. So it's not just about running around and give everybody a hug. It's being affectionate, appropriate to the person you're with. So if you're a person who's very, very formal, just maybe a two-handed handshake conveys a lot of affection. But the next person might be more gregarious, and they might want a massive hug for a long time and just to be held.
In a situation like that, if you're visiting people who mm-hmm. are sick and you don't know everybody, then what do you do? You just ask them, would you like me to hold your hand, or would you like a hug, or do you ask, or?
You can ask, yeah, especially about a hug. It's mm-hmm. like, would you like a hug? It's a simple question. They'll say yes or no.
Right.
You know?
Right.
As you're engaging, you know, you're paying attention to what's going on. The body language, the tone of voice, and also what they're saying. But particularly body language and tone of voice. And that will give you a clue if they're warming up to you, opening up to you, or they're still maintaining a more distance. And if you gently, like, lean in a bit closer, you'll get a sense of, is that okay with them, or is it making them nervous? You know, you'll just get that body feel for, is this welcome, or is it felt as an intrusion? And if it's not welcome, you know, you just back off a little bit, you know? If it is welcome, lean in a bit more. You know, it's more like a dance. Than a formula or anything. It's this ebb and flow to it. It's this getting to know you kind of ebb and flow. And the whole conversation's like that. There's a beginning and a middle and an end to it. And the idea is to make them all as graceful as possible. And it's not so much about what you say. I mean, we call the book What Can I Say? It's actually the wrong question. But because it's the one everybody asks, we thought we'd better answer it, and then segue over to, you know, it's more about how can I be of service to a person, you know, and what do they want? So it's not about what I say. It's about what would they like, and what would serve them, and what would be inspiring or uplifting or comforting to them. What's of interest? What are they interested in?
Wouldn't you say it's listening? It's listening on a very high level. You know, you're listening to what they say, but you're also listening to what they don't say.
Correct. Oh, yeah, exactly. So those, sometimes when they, you know, partway through a sentence and they stop talking, it's like, I wonder what is in the silence there that, you know, they were about to say. In fact, the former president of our board, a wonderful doctor, Dr. David Chernoff, he said the most important thing he ever learned in medical school was, his professor told him, he said, the most important thing a person's ever going to say, a patient's ever going to tell you, is the thing that's on the tip of their tongue just as you're about to walk out the room. Mm. And if there was a little bit more time or a little bit more trust or a little bit more listening, they would actually say what they really needed to say. But you've got to, there's got to be that felt sense of trust.
And patience, right?
And patience, exactly.
And maybe taking in a bit of the silence, because sometimes it may take them time to speak up. So there's no need to rush them. Just kind of go with it, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, there's no, you can't say, you know, go deep and make it snappy. You know, it's too massive. You know?
I love that. Go deep and make it snappy. Now that's funny.
You know, it's...
Well, move it along here.
Yeah, move it along. Get profound. Come on, make it quick.
Wow.
Yeah, our human foibles are...
Now, you also talk about the value of compassion. So let's talk about giving the gift of compassion and the four elements of compassion and how we
sure.
put them in practice.
Well, in our conversation so far, we've really covered the four elements. We call them the four A's because they are attention, acknowledgement, affection, and acceptance. And what we found is those are the minimum number of things we need to do for the other person to experience compassion. And so those are four practicable skills that we can get better at. We can all get better at paying attention to the other person. We can all get better at acknowledging other people. We can all get better at showing affection to other people. We all get better at accepting them. And our method is to identify, you know, what gets in the way, the barriers to those things, what gets in the way of us noticing what's important to people. It's usually our agenda or our assumptions, things like that. So you identify the barriers. You also identify the builders, which is what helps you, for example, to pay attention. That would be, well, when you give people choices, ask them, what would you like? Is it okay if I visit right now? Is this a good time? Give people choices. It empowers them. But it also gets your attention over to them to listen for the answer. So there's little things like that you can do to get better at it. And we've our program that we where we teach pre-med and pre-nursing students these skills at the front end of their career before they go to medical school or nursing school. There's a reflective practice built in. So they go out and they visit people who are alone in nursing homes or in the hospital. And they, but then they don't just visit. Afterwards, they write about it and they reflect on their experience. So they are integrating it. They're essentially digesting the experience and making sense of it by writing it down, sending it to us, and then we can coach them based on what they write because we get a sense of how perceptive their interaction was. So that's how you build and. How we define compassion is by going back to the Latin root of the word, which is compati, C-O-M-P-A-T-I. So com means together or with, and pati means to suffer or to feel intensely, you know, the passion, like the passion of the Christ, right? So compati means to suffer with or to be with someone who is suffering. And so we see like there's like really three main kinds of compassion. What I've just described is the third kind The first two are compassion is giving to people who don't have food, medicine, shelter, clothing. You know, someone who doesn't have something, you can give something to them, and that's compassion. Then there's the doing for. Most of healthcare is about doing for people who cannot do it for themselves. You know, can't do heart surgery for yourself. You need somebody's help to do it. And you need nurses to look after you afterwards. You know, so there's the doing for. That, of course, is absolutely beautiful compassion. But then there's also the being with part of it. And that's the only kind that you can't do at a distance. You have to be fully present in body and mind and heart and soul. And the being with form of compassion is the one that's kind of gotten left out. We got so enamored by everything we could do, we forgot about being with. And it's the being with that alleviates the loneliness, that is the antidote to the social isolation. In fact, it's the only thing that is the antidote. There's no medicine for that, as my wife Karen would say. There's no pill for loneliness. You know, it's not a medical problem. It's a human problem, and it requires a human solution, which is a person showing up in person and connecting with someone and building that bridge between the two worlds so that you are connected. There's that sense of connectedness. There's a healing connection that happens. And those are the things that people can hold on to. Those are the things that bring the reason to live to the fore, and can really make all the difference in the world, in the quality of life, in the quality of death. What we're doing, sometimes we call it the alchemy of compassion, because it really changes suffering into love, into understanding, into wisdom, into gratitude. It changes the experience of illness rather than just trying to escape from it, which, of course, we should make every endeavor to help heal the illness. Absolutely, we should. But along with that, if we add the compassion, it changes the perspective of everything and the experience of it. So, you know, we can either be some people, sometimes we are traumatized by illnesses because we've had to face them alone or in bad conditions. And sometimes illnesses can be a breakthrough. You know, like some athletes have said, you know, cancer, best thing that ever happened to me. It kind of woke me up, you know. And if with support, when people are treated with compassion, they remember those moments forever. And sadly, they remember the moments of neglect, too. How people treat us in those key pivotal moments in life when we are vulnerable, we always remember those. They're like indelible.
Yeah, precious moments.
They are, and we can turn them. We can turn them towards healing, and make them beautiful moments in life. That, yes, okay, they were painful, but they made us more who we are. You know, we grew, or our souls got deeper as a result. You know, like a lot of soldiers have, you know, stories on the battlefield that were painful, but the bravery they experienced or the sacrifice they witnessed made them a better person. So that's where we're coming from. It's not just a rose-colored glasses thing. It's more seeing, well, what's really going on here? How can we be present with this, be as conscious as we possibly can, and as heartfelt as we can? I mean, this is really, going back, I mentioned, you know, my background is in physics, and I've always said, you know, compassion is an energy. And people go, well, how can you say that? You can't measure it. You can't see it. What the heck is it? You know? And I said, well, it's an energy, because energy is defined as the capacity to do work. And compassion can change lives. And that's a whole lot of work.
Yeah.
And so that's my 5 cents on my physics soapbox. But that's it.
Well, that's great. I love that. Yeah. So how do we prepare ourselves to visit someone who's ailing? What are some of the do's and don'ts? And how long should we visit? And when do you know it's time to leave?
Ah, right. Well, those are all big questions. I think the preparation is essentially being in your heart and being willing to serve. It's making it so it's not about you. You know, that usually, typical mistakes people make are go in and, ask the patient, how's your blood work? What did the doctor say? What's the prognosis? What's coming up next? And the patient feels like they've got to do a report for everybody who walks in that door, both the staff and also family and friends. And they're constantly reporting on their illness. And it becomes very tiring. And it's like the patient's having to put on a good front and be up for the people who are coming to visit because they don't want to upset them, or worry them. And it's like, well, don't we have this, bass ackwards on that? It's like, just a minute. I mean, we shouldn't be supporting the person who's struggling with this illness. So being in your heart and wondering, well, I wonder what they would need or want, or I wonder what they would like to read. Or just going there, how can I serve is the best attitude. And being in your heart and actually deciding to, ahead of time, that you're going to try and enjoy your time together. You're going to, or let me put it a better way, to appreciate the time you've got together. Because you don't know how much longer you have. I mean, none of us do, even on a good day. We don't know how long we've got. So time together is precious. And so that's, I would say, preparing and not having any expectations of them or yourself. You might have visited them a couple of days ago. Don't expect it's going to be the same again today. Because with illness, stuff can happen fast and abilities can fluctuate wildly. So that's the prep. And then you ask something else about after the prep.
When do you know it's time?
How long should one
visit, and when do you know it's time to leave?
Shorter is better, unless they want you to be there. When people are in pain, it's difficult for them to pay attention and to concentrate. So, like I said, it's like a dance, and it's like having a sense of good timing is important. We use something called a felt shift that we talk about. Was this where you feel like something's changed in the conversation, and that might be an appropriate point to leave? Say you're visiting, and you've been visiting for 5 or 10 minutes. I mean, some obvious felt shifts are they're starting to fall asleep. Well, okay, let them.
Let them get
their rest. So that would be a clue.
What about asking them?
Sorry.
What about just asking them?
You can do that, or if they're looking at their watch, or if you can tell if they're getting, you watch their body language. It will usually tell you. If they're really engaged and enjoying the conversation and they're thriving from it, hey, stay there. Sometimes you have a wonderful, in-depth, one-hour conversation. It'd be fantastic. Other times, short and sweet. All they need is a 30-second, hi, how are you? That's all they needed right then. But you can often get this sense of, like I said, an ebb and a flow to the conversation. It's like the tide takes you in to visit with them, and you're there for a period, and then the tide takes you out, back out the room, and you're on your way again. And it's trying to get a sense of that feeling of, like, the Tao of it, if you will, the ebb and flow of the conversation. But if in doubt, gently start to leave. And sometimes what happens is sometimes we call it wrong. We think they're tiring or we think they're not interested. But if you leave in a gentle way, you kind of inch your way to the edge of your seat as if you're about to stand up, and then they might reach over and hold you a bit, you know, hold your hand a bit tighter. And that would be saying, you know, don't go just yet, you know. And sometimes people, they can't keep up the conversation with you just because they're not well enough to do so, but they still want you to be there because you make them feel safe.
Yeah, they want and that connection.
They want that connection. I mean, some of our students get asked, you know, they're in there visiting with somebody elderly, and they said, would you please just stay here and sit with me while I fall asleep? I mean, how tender is that? I mean, it's beautiful, and how safe do they feel with somebody that way, you know? So it's this feeling of, you know, I guess I just say follow your heart. You know, your heart has an intelligence too. And if that's saying stay, then stay. And if it's saying go, go. We'll listen to it.
Yeah. And is it okay to cry when you visit someone who's ailing?
Yeah. Let me tell you Karen's rule about crying. Don't cry louder or longer than the patient. In other words, you don't upstage them or as other nurse educators have said, you don't cry to the point where they are needing to comfort you. Right? So
right.
If you shut right, so
it's like who needs help here?
right. Then yeah, not that. But for somebody who's in a lot of pain, or somebody who needs to tell you a story that's particularly heartbreaking or tragic, when you shed a tear in response to them saying that, that's saying, you know, I'm human and I hear what you're saying. That's painful. And that it's respectful to do that because you've been moved by their story. And that is entirely appropriate and beautiful. It's like, no, I get it. And you, yeah. But you don't get into upstaging the patient or, you know, like I said, crying louder or longer.
Yeah. So how do we handle communication when an illness is terminal?
Really no different. It's still, in fact, everything I said and all the more so.
Yeah.
It all the more so. It's all that much more important, and every signal they send is more, you know, crucial to pick up on the best you can. I mean, we're all going to make mistakes. Nobody's going to do, and this is not about us doing it perfectly. It's about doing it with heart and doing the best we can and keep on learning. So, because what happens is you actually do get better and better at this. It is a skill. It is an art that we get better at. And at first, for example, if you have a decent length of relationship with someone, you might not be able to understand them at first. Say you're visiting someone who has a stroke, and they can be difficult to understand. But if you visit week in, week out, you actually begin to develop a bit of an ear, or to be able to pick up more signals from their body language or their tone of voice, and you start to cotton on to what they're saying a bit better. And so your ear develops, or your ability to discern what they're trying to say or what they mean gradually gets better and better. And that's actually the beauty of this work, that we can progress in our ability to connect with people. And what you first visit you thought was an impossible situation, you were never going to be able to understand what they were saying. After a few weeks, you're starting to realize, oh, that's what he meant or she said, or now I'm starting to get a hang of it, you know. So it your senses actually adjust to that.
Yeah.
If you're sincere about it.
Yeah. And what about children? When you're visiting children, should you have a different approach? And also, what about taking children to visit people who are ill?
Right. Well, when visiting children, again, the same applies. Those four A's we have found are universal. They work with all forms of life, and not just humans. So you pay attention to an animal. You acknowledge it. You show affection. You accept it. It will respond to you beautifully, right? And children are the same. Actually, even more so, because often children are told what to do more than they are listened to.
Right.
Right? And so when you actually take an interest in what they're thinking and feeling and imagining and what's important to them, it can be a revelation to them that this adult is actually interested in them. And it's a big deal. So it can be even more important to them. And they soak up affection. They just soak it up. And acknowledgement, telling them that you're proud of how brave they are or how they're handling this. But make the acknowledgement genuine, so it's speaking to something that's really there. And then accepting them for their strengths and their weaknesses and all of it. It's magical when you do that with children. As for taking children to visit someone who is ill, I would, if possible, if you've made a visit prior to that, that would be good. But say it's children visiting grandparents in the hospital or something like that. I think when it's done right, and actually you can teach these 4 A's to kids. We've taught these things to elementary school children and had them visit elders in the nursing homes. And they have been magnificent. Their ability to show affection is way better than ours, usually. and their acceptance of people, they seem all like grandmas and grandpas. And actually, I just came across a wonderful article in the Irish Times, and the title of it is "Our Grandparents' Dementia Didn't Matter to Us as Children." And it's true. I mean, we accepted the grandparents as is. You know, my grandpa had a wooden leg. You know, it wasn't weird. It was just, that's who he is, you know. And some have, you know, different characteristics. It's just who they are. So children are very accepting and can be very therapeutic for an older person to interact with. Children are usually naturally keen observers if you point them in the right direction. Mostly what we had to do with children was help take away the scary pictures, sometimes by addressing it in advance. You know, it's like letting them know what they're about to see. You know, grandma's, you know, can't speak very well right now. You know, she's had a stroke. Like, explain it up front so they're not shocked by it. But then you've paved the way for them to have a beautiful interaction. So I think we try to shelter our children a little too much, where if they're exposed to the actual realities of life and illness and death, but done in a constructive and positive way, where it can be a positive experience for them, they can grow up so fast that way, emotional maturity.
Yeah. Just a beautiful sharing here. I just love the work that you do. So tell us about the Adventures in Caring Foundation. You know, what is it about Raggedy Ann and Raggedy Andy that helps to uplift those? And who is involved with Adventures in Caring, and who does the organization serve, and how can others help the organization?
Well, you're going to have to remind me of those questions again. So the thing about Raggedy Ann, people think it's about the costume. It isn't. It's about the skills we've been talking about this last hour. That's really the magic. We used the character Raggedy Ann. It was Karen's idea. And it was an intuition that she had to deliver, or I should say present, a safe character. I think intuitively she knew that people who are ill in the hospital or the nursing home, they feel vulnerable, and even at a more primal level, they feel scared. They feel threatened, because any animal that is injured feels like easy prey. It's a primal instinct. And therefore, we feel threatened. Therefore, the stress hormones are being released and all the neurotransmitters that go with them. And so we're in a kind of a fight or flight type of state, except we can't run anywhere because we're stuck. So the threat level is high. And if you bring, so to counteract that, if you bring a safe character, an ally who is on your side, then the threat level comes down. And that you could say that is the biological function of compassion, is it to reduce threat. And that statement is bolstered by Professor Jim Blaskovich, who's just come on our board of directors, whose lifetime's work has been this biopsychosocial model of challenge and threat, and tipping threat into a more challenge. Instead of being scared out of your mind, seeing it as a challenge, and how you do that is through allies and resources to help you. In other words, somebody in your corner. So Karen had this inspiration, and if people are interested in the whole story, I would recommend going to our website, and there are a lot of videos on there from student volunteers, and also Karen telling the story of how she got started. But I think we're running out of time for me to be able to tell that story, and she tells it better than I do anyway. But Adventures in Caring as an organization, what we're about is teaching compassion as a practice in the service of healing. So not compassion as a philosophy or a feeling, but actually as a skill, as something people can walk in the door and help somebody with. And so by making this connection, because it's compassion is the glue, if you will, that connects us, or the magnetic field that links us together, so that we don't feel all alone in anymore. And that feeling of isolation and being isolated, that can happen even in a crowd of people, obviously increases the threat level. When you feel all alone, and hospitals and nursing homes can be scary places for people. And so, what we're about is providing volunteers and who can accompany people through some of the most difficult passages in their life, and do it with a great heart. And so what they do as a result is restore well-being to the residents in nursing homes and the patients in hospitals. So there's definitely biological changes that happen as a result, and there's also psychological changes that happen, and people tend to heal up faster, or they have to have a more peaceful passing, or the quality of life in the final years is far, far better because they have a friend. So it comes down to being simply, a very good friend and befriending people in their time of need. That's one half of it. The other half is, who is learning to do this are future doctors and future nurses and future health workers. So they are learning the skills on how do you treat a patient with compassion. What is that? And they're not just hearing about it, but they're actually developing the skills through a one-year-long service learning program. So they're visiting every week for school year and getting input from us and coaching from us, and then being involved in training of others, so that for at least a year they are building skills. And our goal is that they have these skills for the rest of their life, that not even medical school can knock it out of them. So the skills are in their bones after a year. And for them on to the rest of their life, this is how they will naturally treat people. So this is the ripple of compassion we're working on sending out to the world. And even though we're a tiny organization in Santa Barbara, California, our programs are being used in about 1,000 hospices throughout the United States and about 1,000 hospitals. About 400 nursing schools use our stuff, and a couple of thousand churches, too. And increasingly worldwide. Our most recent program was all about how to prevent compassion fatigue. That's now, last year was presented in China and Romania and Kenya. So there's a huge need and for this work and this skill, because we've essentially figured out how to make this invisible nebulous stuff called compassion. We've made it visible by putting it in a raggedy uniform and walking it in the door. We've made it teachable by having this 4 A's model to help people understand how to do it and get better at it. We've made it practical by putting it on video, and so that people can use our videos to teach their teams. And now we're in the phase of making it, continue all those, and now we're trying to find ways to gauge progress and measure results, and so that it can be replicated even more far and wide. So it's a 30-year so far effort. I figure it's about a 5-step, 50-year plan. But at the end of that, we will have an amazing, reliable way to teach compassion globally, and people around the world to treat each other a whole lot better than we currently do.
Yeah. It's just beautiful, beautiful work.
Thank you. Yeah. I mean, if people are interested, let me just say this. If you ever wondered that the healing power of love was for real, I would say go to our website and listen to some of the stories of transformation of our student volunteers, and you will find that the real deal. We're not using this saying that. I'm not saying that metaphorically. I'm saying it. No, it changes lives. It truly does. And so that would be www.adventuresincaring.org.
Yeah, I love it. I love the work that you do. I mean, you and I could go on and on. I mean,
yeah,
because,
I know.
Because compassion, you know, it really is a huge topic, isn't it? And there's a lot of work. To be done with compassion.
There is. I think it's a field in its infancy, really, in many ways. I mean, I wish that wasn't so. I wish we were all experts at it. But right now, but the research is coming along. I mean, even at UCLA, they're finding in genetics, they're finding genes that turn on or off in the presence of compassion.
Wow.
And they're mostly to do with inflammation, you know? And more inflammation when people feel threatened, less inflammation when they feel comforted and the experience of compassion.
Yeah, beautiful, so, beautiful work. Yeah. I love your work. Thank you so much for
all that you
and your lovely wife, Karen. Thank you so much to both of you and your team.
The students are amazing, and it gives you hope for the future to see these bright young men and women doing amazing stuff making friends with people who are 5 times their age and becoming fast friends. It's a beautiful thing.
Right. It's really like the connecting of souls, like you said.
It is.
Earlier.
Yeah.
So do you have anything to share that we haven't covered? I think we covered a lot, and there's always more, right?
There is. There's always more. I mean, this is a work of the heart. It does require funding to make it happen, as like most things. So if people can donate, it would be huge. And with our program, a relatively modest donation makes a massive difference. So if anybody wants to have a pivotal difference in the world, they can make one through Adventures in Caring. They really can. We're in this for the long haul, and Karen and I have dedicated our lives to it. We've put a stake in the ground, and it's called compassion, and it's what we're about. It's what we'll always be about. And I welcome participation, whether that be volunteering or helping in whatever way people can, or funding. Absolutely, we need that. But connections, too. I mean, if you know somebody who is teaching at a nursing school or, you know, or at a college and would be interested in teaching something like this, or at their church or at their hospital. We've got materials that can help. And so please link them up to us, Adventures in Caring, or send me an email, or you can send it through the site, info@adventuresincaring.org. Those kinds of things, I encourage people, don't be a passive participant. This is not a spectator sport. This is, you know, you can go visit somebody, and if your grandparents are not nearby, find some who are, find some people, or teach young people these skills. They're eager for it. They're hungry for it. It makes a tremendous difference to young people to find that they can connect with anybody, regardless of age or illness, disability, race, religion. Once they have the ability to connect, they can go anywhere. And yeah. So it's a great gift that we can give to the upcoming generation.
That's beautiful. So. Well, thank you so much for sharing.
You're welcome. I apologize for the sirens. It's an ambulance going by right
well,
now.
Well, that's okay. But, you know, I want to thank you for all the work that you're doing and encourage people to visit your website, which is adventuresincaring.org. And I'm going to close, if you don't mind. I'm just going to read page 70 in your book, which is You Have a Gift. I'll just close with that, unless you have something else to add. And just thank you so much again.
Oh, please do. Please do.
Okay.
Thank you.
We'll take care.
You too, Andrea. Thank you.
It's a real pleasure. You have a gift. When Karen began her work as a Raggedy Ann, people would say to her, "How wonderful of you to visit the sick. You have a gift for lifting the spirit during a crisis." Then glancing downward, they'd often say, "But I could never do that." Karen would respond gently, "Oh, yes, you can. You must have this gift too, because if you didn't, you couldn't recognize it in me. You too have a gift to give, visiting people who are sick and in the hospital or at home will open your heart and deepen your insight into the meaning of life. You can make a bigger difference than you realize in the recovery of your friends and family members if you listen and speak from your heart. There is no pill to alleviate the loneliness and heartache of being sick. But in the darkest hours of an illness or injury, your kindness and compassion, the healing power of love, is the medicine that touches the soul and brings a ray of welcomed light." Beautiful. And that's from the book, What Can I Say? A Guide to Visiting Friends and Family Who Are Ill, by Simon and Karen Fox. I would like to thank our guest, Simon Fox, for being here to discuss What Can I Say? A book by Simon and Karen Fox, and it's a guide to visiting friends and family who are ill. For more information, please visit www.adventuresincaring.org. I would like to encourage all of our listeners to practice the universal law of giving by doing whatever you can to reach out to help others. To each and every one of you out there, thank you so much for joining me, Andrea Garrison, and connecting here online with Andrea. Listen to me live or listen to the archive. Just continue connecting heart to heart. But in the meantime, do what you can, whatever you can, to reach out to help others. And never underestimate the power of a friendly smile. Take care. We'll be right back.
Thank you for connecting to Online with Andrea with your host, Andrea Garrison.